The meeting will come to order. Members, we have two sets of minutes, but I have a motion for Thursday, January 25th.
So moved, Madam Chair.
So moved with that. I'm sorry, I can't even hear here. Who was it? Representative Benson? Okay. Representative Benson moves approval of the minutes for January 25th. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes, the motion prevails, the minutes are approved. And then we have already, thanks to our very wonderful staff here, the minutes from our hearing from last night.
Wow.
Representative Dominguez, would you like to move approval of those?
I sure would, Madam Chair.
And we thank you so much for that meeting. I don't know if you want to say a word of thanks to the members or comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly would like to thank each and every one of you coming out to District 58. I believe now that you get a better picture of what I'm up against and what we are up against for our kids here in the state of Minnesota. But I sincerely thank you for coming out, and you heard some good testimony from not only the teachers, but you heard it from the community, the children, the parents. And I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for having that opportunity to bring folks out to my district again, 58. Let's make it better for the kids. That's what this is all about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I also would like to thank our staff for that as well, because we just showed up, but they went to a heck of a lot of work, groundwork to do that. And for the few members who were not able to be there, and I know we have a lot of calls on our commitments here at the legislature, it was a wonderful hearing. We heard a lot of the things we hear at the Capitol, but with a lot more flavor, and it was a pleasure for all of us to be there. So any discussion on approval of the minutes from last night?
Madam Chair.
Representative Swales.
It's minor, but I'm a member of both committees and was omitted from the E-12 members. So. But I was there. I mean, I'm in the other list. So. But
oh,
I'm
okay.
On both.
Okay, so in other words, Representative Swales, you need to be added to the members present for the
E-12
as well. Okay, very good. Yeah, it gets confusing with these joint minutes. And some members said they were needed to be excused to one committee or the other, and we had to get that all straight as well. So we will add you to the E-12 as well. Any other, and PEC members, it's always a good idea to look at the minutes and make sure that your name is where it should be if you were present. So if anybody else notices anything, if not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay. We have had, the last couple weeks, we've had the Department of Education, and sometimes we forget that we have other agencies in our state government, and we're going to hear from two of them today that also cover, and we have their accounts in our education finance budget. So we need to review their requests, what the governor proposes for them, and then we decide what the House proposal will be for them. And so we're going to spend the first half of our time with the Purpich Center for the Arts and the second half of our time with the Minnesota State Academies. So it's my privilege to introduce to the committee, and many of you know these fine people already, but Dr. Nathan Davis, who is the executive director of the Purpich Center, and Dr. Pam Pearson, I know a Pam Pearson too, so I know you're Pam Paulson. Dr. Pam Paulson, who is the deputy director from the Purpich Center. I don't know which one's going first, but whichever one is, if you could state your name for the tape and then proceed. Welcome.
I am Nathan Davis, executive director of the Purpich Center for Arts Education, and I will let Pam introduce herself because we're going to have a PowerPoint presentation for you, so I'd rather not have her interrupt her flow as we're going to go back and forth and talk to you a little bit about our work.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Pam Paulson. I'm the deputy director of the Purpich Center for Arts Education.
Okay, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for taking the time to focus in on the Purpich Center for Arts Education today. We have developed a presentation for you that attempts to tell you about who we are, what we do, who we have been, our role, were highly unusual. When I've spoken to some of you individually, I like to frame us as an interesting double-edged sword because we're unusual. You know, why are we here? And on the other hand, I like to think that we represent an unusual opportunity and that our work will clarify that for you. So, number one, moving through our PowerPoint here, who are we? We're an agency, as you know. Our mission, sometimes it's interesting we do our work and you forget the exact mission, is to improve K-12 education for all Minnesota students and educators through innovative programs and partnerships centered in the arts. We like to look at ourselves as improving the larger educational spectrum. And yes, we're passionate about the arts' ability to do that. One of the things that I've discovered working at Purpich for a year and a half is how well-regarded we are nationally, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but I think suffice to say we are a place whose work and thinking has strong peer recognition across the country. I believe that we're an agency that can be very useful to our own work and to the work of the greater educational world because we create unique cross-set sector collaborations. For instance, I sit before you today having been head in the higher education world of a consortium that had an education leadership program that Representative Paul Marcourt is a graduate of, and yet I'm now wearing a hat with a supervisory relationship without that licensure myself in the K-12 world. I like to think I have something to offer the K-12 world, but I would say that this is an out-of-the-box model. We operate with guiding principles to be expansive, to be a valuable resource, and to empower people. We passionately believe our work is about that, and we believe that we need to take risks and that we're about constant innovation. Pam Paulson's work has been integral to developing Purpich from the beginning. I'm very fortunate to be coming into a position where there is essentially a pioneer and creator, and I would say very much ongoing trooper, instigator, implementer at my side who is extremely well known nationally. And to tell you something about where we have come from, I'm going to pass the PowerPoint flow over to Pam.
Dr. Paulson.
Thank you very much. One of our arts high school teachers actually put this PowerPoint together for us along with students who had input into it. And it's very interesting because we thought you might appreciate hearing a little bit about where the center came from, how it was developed, and you know what? The kids did too. They didn't know all of this information, so we found this to be a nice collaboration with teachers and students as well. What we'd like to do is talk with you a little bit about where the Purpich Center came from and put that in the context of what was going on in the world at the same time. And a lot of what you'll see on these quick little slides that pass by are things that have to do with the arts, movies, and actors, and dancers, and things like that. And we think of ourselves as a place that has a lot of innovation, and I think that you'll see that we hook into the things that are going on in the world. So we will take you back to the 1980s, because that is actually when the Purpich Center was formed. And you will know that in the 80s was the first time we started to have MTV. We saw Madonna at the top of the charts as America's material girl. Ronald Reagan was the president of the United States. And there was a movie about dancing that dominated the charts, the top of the box office. The Minnesota Twins won the 1987 World Series, and shows like Dallas and Dynasty dominated the evening airways. Big hair, sweatshirts off the shoulder, and leg warmers were all a part of the fashion trend based on the movie Flashdance. Everyone wanted to attend Fame, and you'll have to know that there was some comparisons being made between the Purpich Center and Fame at that time. A lot of them didn't hold up, but just so you know. And then we were a generation
many of them have them.
Who learned to ask, where is the beef? In 1985, middle of those 80s, initial legislation was passed by you to create a new state agency called the Minnesota School of the Arts and Resource Center. And it included an innovative arts high school for 11th and 12th graders with a dormitory that where about 140 students live. It includes a state library that's open to anybody who's 18 or older in our state,
and it has a professional development and research area to provide staff development and resources to teachers across the state. In 1985, the center was formed with six arts areas: dance, literary arts, media arts, music, theater, and visual arts. None of those were highly unusual at that time, except media arts. We think that we were the first in the country to establish standards in media arts for students. In 1986, we were housed downtown St. Paul in Gallery Towers, which was the old Science Museum on Exchange Street. So some of you will know we had offices there before we had a place for our kids. We didn't have the kids yet. And we were about reinventing education through innovative ideas, making education relevant to students' lives, and helping teachers understand and create effective instruction, curriculum, and assessment. Oops, in 1986, we also created our first program for the statewide work, which was called MAX, the Minnesota Arts Experience. And you probably had one of those programs in your community, because they were in 60 communities across the state. And some of them were with students, some of them were for teachers, and some of them combined. Some were residential, and they were at the state universities, and may have been as long as 4 to 6 weeks, having kids engaged in the arts. Then we had a name change. You will start to see a little theme going through here. In 1987, the name of the center was changed to the Minnesota School and Resource Center for the Arts, trying to blend those two parts of the agency a little bit more closely together. We did our first demonstration of what the Arts High School might look like, because we didn't have any kids yet. So we gathered up about 150 teachers and students from around the state. We met at Camp Courage, and we did our first demonstration of integrated learning. We had teachers paired up to teach visual arts and science, dance and math, social studies and music, theater and world languages, and to this day, I can be around the state and someone will come up to me and say, that changed everything about the way I thought about teaching. And it was 20 years ago, a long time ago. In 1989, the center's name changed again. It's now called the Minnesota Center for Arts Education, and we moved from St. Paul in Gallery Towers out to the former Golden Valley Lutheran Junior College site, which is a 30-acre campus out in Golden Valley, and we opened our doors for our first students in September of 1989. That year, we also started our second statewide professional development program called POP, Professional Opportunities Programs for Teachers and Administrators and Artists to Study the Arts. Well, welcome to the 1990s. We're in a new decade, and you will recognize...
I told him to leave OJ out.
The decade of all things plaid. We see Rachel and Ross and their epic romance and friends. Some of you still may be watching that show. We saw Princess Diana and Madonna taught America to strike a pose with Vogue. We had President George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton in the Oval Office. Dolly was cloned. We saw Desert Storm every night on television, and we worshipped the Lion King. And the 1990s raged on. We graduated our very first class from the Arts High School. We called them the Alpha Class in 1991. Between 1993 and 94, the Purpich Center convened partners to develop a statewide vision, mission, and set of goals for arts education in Minnesota, and we called it Sculpting the Future. We included school districts, that was teachers and administrators, we had members of higher education, major arts organizations, small arts organizations, and parents and students, and we met three times over the course of 2 years to establish that vision and mission. In 1994, the legislature gave us additional duties, additional responsibilities for gathering and conducting research, designing and promoting additional opportunities for Minnesota students and in secondary and elementary schools, and serving as a liaison for the Minnesota Department of Education with national organizations. In 1995 and 96, we became part of a state consortium that's actually housed in the Council of Chief State School Officers called SCAS, and we're working still with that group to understand better how to do good assessment for arts education. And guess what? In 1996, our name changed. It became, the center's name became the Lola and Rudy Perpich Minnesota Center for Arts Education. Between 1997 and 99, we published the first frameworks for arts curriculum strategies called FACTS, and we created the first best practice network, which is now called the Quality Teaching Network. In 1999, the legislature changed our name to the Perpich Center for Arts Education. And we are welcoming in a new millennium. This is the decade where tensions began with the Y2K bug and the hanging chads. This is a picture of our chads. And Americans were torn between buying a Hummer and a Prius. We're drinking Red Bulls so we can have enough energy to make it through the day because coffee's not enough anymore. George Bush Jr. is our presidential leader, and we love our reality TV at night. We're thinking more organically, and Madonna still keeps us captivated with a new look and a new sound. Lance Armstrong is inspiring all of us to overcome difficulties. Cirque Soleil, who's been in town a number of times, some of you may have seen them, still awes and amazes us. And Harry Potter gets kids to read and dazzles and mystifies us on the big screen. In 2000, the Perpich Center assisted the Minnesota Board of Teaching with the development of licensures for teachers in dance and theater, because we already had licensure in visual arts and music, but not dance and theater. We now have it in all four. And we also assisted the legislature and the Department of Education with the development of K-12 standards for arts education and a graduation requirement so that all of our high school students in Minnesota must meet a graduation requirement in the arts. In 2004, we published a new state framework for arts education, which was sent to every school, elementary, middle, and high school, and it's called Engaging Students in the Arts, Creating, Performing, and Responding, and we think it's been a very valuable resource.
And I have entered the scene at this point, and we're now working with a three-year, $1.2 million grant from the Department of Education connected to the Quality Teaching Network model. I found it to be a fascinating integration of professional development and research. And in 2007, we can say we're serving as a resource and inspiration to thousands of teachers and students from all parts of Minnesota. And we feel that we're an institution that's working on all of our cylinders.
Some of you may have seen this new book. It came out just last month in 2007. It's called Tough Choices or Tough Times. The quote that I want to finish my section of this PowerPoint with comes from that book. And it's published, it's about from the new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce. It says, this is a world in which a very high level of preparation in reading, writing, speaking, math, history, and the arts will be an indispensable foundation for everything that comes after for most members of the workforce. It's a world in which comfort with ideas and abstraction is the passport to a good job, in which creativity and innovation are the key to the good life, in which high levels of education, a very different kind of education than most of us have had, are going to be the only security there is. It depends on a deep vein of creativity that is constantly renewing itself, and on a myriad of people who can imagine how people can use things that have never been available before. The best employers the world over will be looking for the most competent, most creative, and most innovative people on the face of the earth, and they will be willing to pay them top dollar for their services. This is a controversial new document, but it really is pushing in this direction of innovation and creativity as the place that our country will be able to keep its edge.
And connecting to that, finishing off our presentation, what we do, who we serve, what we've accomplished, we are part of a creative economy. I believe that we're part of the larger spectrum that has been so successful in the last 40 years, where you see have seen the incubation and success of major arts organizations. I think many of the magnet programs and other programs where students have had a large access to the arts and I would say interdisciplinary education approaches have been at least assisted by the work of Perpich. The other bullet points here have already been spoken about in terms of our statewide role. the fact that we are connected to national policy and bring that initiatives and thinking and bring that to the state. And again, I've spoken to the fact that we fluidly operate. I believe this is one of our great values, as I've worked with the agency for a year and a half, that the conversations that you have with private sector folks, content people, method folks, discipline leaders, a Department of Education, you policymakers, the way we can bring people together is very important. And I have learned one lesson in my former life working in political environment where one politician said the most important thing about the job is the power to convene. And I think we do have that. I don't know if we have the power, but I think we certainly do convene folks. And we work towards educational improvement in a very thorough fashion, mirroring the work of a Department of Education, in that we establish standards, we help folks meet them, and we help them assess them. And we serve a lot of people, many communities, school districts, teachers. Our current calculations that I got for this presentation are over 7,000. And 5,000 students, and as you probably know, 310 students from the Arts High School. Some comments about our students. Data is certainly available in a lot of places, but just to summarize some of it, we operate with 100% graduation rate. Approximately 90% go on to some kind of higher education option. We had 6 national merit commendations and a finalist. 3 National Arts Recognition and Talent Search Awards, which is, as points out on the slide, the national merits of the arts. 26 Scholastic Art Award winners, including 4 at the national level. Work featured at 11 film festivals nationally. Our media arts program, as was pointed out earlier, if not the actual pioneer, has been exceedingly pioneering in that area. And I invite you to think of the added value that we have provided the state by incubating and bringing forth a program that not only is dealing with the arts, but with the digital technology era. And, oh, I forgot the most important one, which actually hit me. Look at the amount of scholarships our kids got. I kind of got the calculator. That's almost $19,000 a student. That is our graduating class last year. Apparently it was a record, so, and I can't give you data in terms of how that compares, but I was well taken with that. And some comments from our students about us.
Just so you know, all of these photographs that are on the side of the pages are really from our school, from our center, and our students. These are 2 quotes from students that we currently have on campus. One said, "Never before have I had an experience like Purpich. Here we can express ourselves through the arts while improving our intellect through rigorous classes." And another one said, "This is one of the few places where people want to be here and want to study. This is rare. How many students want to go to school? How many students want to stay up late and work on artwork, not because they need to meet a deadline, but because they love their art? This is a rare and exceptional institution."
Okay. And I'm going to move quickly through the next couple of slides. I think it's important in our accomplishments that we publish. And we have important works that are called on and used by many folks. And as you can see there, we've been the recipient in the past decade of $6 million in external grants, and I think this is certainly an important part of our work to be engaged and be acquiring external funding for projects. You've seen the comments about our graduation rate. We've just put down a few specifics in terms of students who have done well, not just in the arts. We see that consistently from our perspective. So you see the citation of the Siemens Westinghouse Award for Science, Math, and Technology there as well. We couldn't resist throwing that in. I also, in the next slide, want to point out that I think that different kinds of our programs, if you target in on them, have been very good added value for state investment. That $45,000 annually of MDE money has been converted to over, it's actually, I think, closer to $600,000, but over $500,000 from non-state sources. It includes the federal grant. And I think our CAP program is one that we need to study more because we've worked in so many communities. And yes, there's been state money invested, but I'll tell you, just the one that I put up there alone is an example where you can get a community working and get a lot going. And we have evidence from Dawson and other communities as well of the power of this program. Our goals, as you can see, are very broad-based. I'll just let you glance at them. And I'll move to areas that we'd like to be working more aggressively with in the future. In technology, we feel that we could be an incubator and model for how districts can acquire different kinds of distance learning kinds of approaches, especially relating to our professional development models. So we're very interested in working in this vein. We have a collaboration with Minsky right now with their D2L software, so we're actually beginning right now to be bringing professional development across the state through distance learning technologies. We would like to be able to do more of it, and we feel resources would help. Because we're an 11th, 12th grade school, we're constantly delving into the transition of where kids are at, what kinds of curricular rigor do they need, how does this segue into their life in higher education. We think we have a lot that we can do and work on in that regard as well. And we feel that we can do an increasingly good and important job of reaching students all over, whether it be in rural settings or urban settings. I came to this job even though I'm an Easterner and not a native originally. I lived in Fargo Moorhead for 15 years, and I have a very strong sense of what it means to have education and culture and the arts be part of invigorating, sustaining communities. And then finally, these action verbs tell you who and what we feel we are, and we want to thank you for listening to us.
Thank you very much. We might know we could expect a creative presentation from the two of you. We have now members about 15 minutes if there are questions, and Representative Ann Zells has gotten on the list early. Representative Ann Zells.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis and Dr. Paulson, I genuinely enjoyed your presentation. I knew Governor Perpich well. He was a visionary, and I really want to compliment you and the students and the parents and the faculty for doing such a wonderful job with his vision. And there are many, many, many people throughout our state who also want to thank you. And sometimes in our business of the hectic lives we have, we don't stop and remember those who really made a contribution. And I really thank you for keeping the governor's vision going. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment. I just want to respond.
Dr. Davis.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to respond that I'm very grateful to hear feedback like that, but I really do want everybody in the room to know the extent to which I feel the responsibility, given our unusual role in public policy, to be constantly responsible to show how we are providing added value. And even though we had perhaps creative aspects of that presentation from where I'm coming from, that's perhaps the most important thing, because you obviously all have a lot of difficult decisions to make as to where dollars go. And I like to feel we're a small place, but we really can help improve the environment usually, and we're a good investment.
Thank you very much. I recently had a chance to read the book by Betty Wilson on Perpich, and it included some very interesting history about the controversies in starting this school that were familiar to me a little bit, because I was lobbying here on another as a volunteer for another group and saw some of those struggles going on. And I even read Representative Anzell's name in the book. He is in there, and so if any of you want to hear how he figures into the Perpich era, you should read that book.
Thank you.
We're getting a longer list here now. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Paulson and Dr. Davis, I just want to make a comment about a personal connection that I have to these two. In 1997, as Dr. Paulson said, the Best Practice Network was selected for arts teachers in the secondary grades. And at that time, I had created a curriculum in theater for middle school and junior high students for our school district. And I can remember very clearly my department chair bringing me an application saying, I think you need to apply for this. This you would fit this very well. And it was during the days of the profile, that beloved profile, that I filled out this application, and I was one of the 50 teachers selected to serve on the Best Practice Network. And I can remember the very first day we met at a hotel over in Richfield, or somewhere. Where was it?
Plymouth, that matter.
Yeah.
Richfield.
Yeah, Plymouth. And sitting there like a deer in the headlights, because they were talking about creating a common rubric for all of these arts areas. And but Pam led us with such grace and such tenacity and such creativity. And the 3 years that I served on the network, it truly was inspirational. Those teachers are the finest in the state, and it continues to regenerate new people and touch more and more students and more teachers. And I know that my teaching blossomed as a result of having been a part of the network. And I am so grateful, and I will be forever grateful for that opportunity to have been exposed to that high level of energy and creativity and the improvement of education for our students.
Thank you very much. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Erickson and Representative Reiling, and as I say, Chair, and Representative Dietrich, and Representative Marquardt, and Representative Ember. I'm going to disappoint you. I'm not going to criticize you this time. In the past, we've had a lot of long battles over the issue of funding for the Purpich School of Arts. But I will agree with the legacy of Rudy Purpich, Representative Anzell. I mean, I knew Rudy and been over the mansion a couple times at breakfast with him over there, and I knew him back in that era. And I remember him coming to my hometown, and my brother got caught with the shoe in his mouth. There was a little sales tax initiated that year, and my brother Charlie, when people paid, and the Purpich taxes, and what the Purpich taxes kept saying, that the people had paid at the till. And all of a sudden, there was Rudy Purpich himself. I am Rudy Purpich. But Rudy had been, but he was there. You can tell a lot of stories about Rudy, but Rudy had always come to the, he wouldn't always, but he'd been to the parade in Freeport a couple times, and he never was in the parade, but he worked the sidelines. Mm-hmm. He'd work the crowds on the side, and he was just a unique character. But anyway, so that said, thank you.
Representative Heidgerken, you never disappoint us. Representative McFarland.
Yes, I have students from my legislative district that have been past or present students, and I've heard very good things about your program. But as one of the many freshmen in this room, could you give us a quick crash course on two areas of funding, one in particular being who pays the tuition? Does the home district pay a portion? And the other part of the question would be, I know you're a residential site also, and where does that funding source come from?
I'll respond.
Dr. Davis.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Our funding all comes directly from the legislature. We get an appropriation, and that funds our whole operation. We apparently were designed that way, going back to our roots, to be a place that was not going to put a dividing line between the, I like to call it the think tank side of us and the school side of us. I like to believe it's what makes us so good. It makes us very complicated to separate. So we get one big lump appropriation. We've been operating with $6.6 million. You can say that's funding a small school. We apparently had a school once that had 30 students, and three came to us. And so, of course, they lose out on that formula funding. But obviously, the students, there is not duplication going on. And in terms of the dorm, students do pay a dorm fee. Currently, it is around 2,500. It's a little under, but there are other fees. It's really more like 2,700. We're at work right now figuring out the real cost because it is subsidized, and that's an issue that we are looking at, even though it's a highly challenging issue as a public organization to find ways that really continue to provide the equity of access and at the same time really find that those that can pay will pay, even though under my administration we are certainly focused on that.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I don't have any perfect stories or so I'll take my questioning somewhere else. Thank you, Representative McFarland. That was part of the question that I wanted to ask. The other piece of the question that I wanted to ask is, this seems like it is quite a diamond in the state of Minnesota. It seems to, but unfortunately, I didn't realize that it was even here until I got to the legislature. And so my question is how do students in the average everyday high schools learn about the Purpich Center for the Arts, and what would be a typical student's pathways to get there?
You want to respond to that, or I have a second?
Dr. Paulson.
Thank you.
We send materials to every school, our high school, so that the students are aware that there's an application deadline coming up in February. We put materials in every public library. We have materials on our website. We do all of these kinds of things, and yet the primary way in which students find out about the Arts High School is from another friend, colleague, or another person, parent. It isn't usually through the written materials because they're young, they're used to using the technology, and often they're students that are really seeking something different, and so they hear, little feelers go up, and when they hear something about the Arts High School, it perks an interest, and then they usually find out more about us via the internet, the website.
Is it okay if I add to that?
Yes, Dr. Davis.
I want to give a response to that question because it's an extremely good one, and there are a couple of parts to it because you talk about not knowing about us. I mean, one of my concerns and interests in how we presented to you was to make sure that people see the 360 that we really are. Most people who do know of us think we're an arts high school. And, of course, I'm very proud of that, and I think that's wonderful. But we really are so much more. And I think as a public policy issue, I'm not in your position, but I guess I would want to look at us as being very much more as well. Not that our high school isn't essentially important and has a meaning to have an arts high school in the state. We need to do a much better job in communications. I think students do know about us. I think we're doing a responsible job, but I think all aspects of our communication need to improve, and that's something I'm very dedicated to trying to do.
Right, I would welcome. I have another question.
Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know? Are you able to tell us how much it is per pupil to fund?
We're able to give you the best we can, pulling it apart, and I was pulling apart those numbers in anticipation of a question like that. We're around $10,000 a student, but it becomes very hard to look at us because some of that administration is, I would say there's very few people at our place that are working on one program. Okay, most teachers are involved in some way in what we do from an outreach perspective. And most of the people involved in outreach are somehow involved in inreach. But I think the best stab we can give you right now is around $10,000.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have another question. Do you, in the schools, we're constantly trying to understand how many free and reduced students we have and the issues that go along with poverty and that type of thing. Do you know how many students that would qualify in the public school for free and reduced, and is there anything different about that within your school system as far as cost or allocation or services? Just would you touch on that a little
bit? Yeah, please.
Dr. Paulson, we have about 2 minutes left of this segment.
All right. We have 310 students in our school. That's 11th and 12th graders. And in this school year, 26 are identified as on free and reduced lunch. That has gone up and down, you know, so that at points we have had as high as 39 of our students, but at points as low as 7. And in part, it depends on how willing they are as high schoolers to identify themselves in that category. It's much different at an elementary level. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we do have a sliding scale for the dormitory costs, and we do have the free and reduced lunch and meal program for them. The students don't pay tuition. They come to us tuition-free, so there's no change that relates to the tuition. But we do try to identify who those students are and give them scholarships through our foundation or a reduced cost for the
QTA.
Oh, and the other thing, yes, that's true. The Quality Teaching Network that was just mentioned, previously called the Best Practice Network, just received a $1.2 million grant to work with schools of high poverty. And so we've been able to really hone in on students outside of our center that also need the arts as a way to learn.
Okay, thank you. We have like just 1 minute left now, but could you just comment like in 1 minute on your assessment of the governor's budget proposal for your school?
Well, I think given where we've come from, which are dramatic cuts, we're at 6.6, but we were at 7.8 in 2003, so we're like a lot of agencies that were trying to absorb, cuts, non-inflationary kinds of views of the situation. We're a small campus, and I think we can be looked at both ways, as we can be looked at as a burden to the state, or we can be looked at as a jewel that needs to be supported properly. I was telling our colleagues at the state academies that I came into a situation where the security had been cut to the point where there was not enough to run our program, and Pam and I still get calls at night from ADT security because we're not confident to raise it to the point where we have 24-hour call, even though I certainly want to. We need more funding, plain and simply, both to do what we do right now and to fully flourish and to expand out in the future.
So are you saying that what is allocated in this year's budget proposal from the governor does not bring you up to the 7.8 that you had in the past? How much short is it, Dr.
The first year, I guess the first year brings us up to a little under 6.8, and then the second year, I believe, brings us a little under 7 million.
Okay,
so
thank
it brings
you.
It, yeah.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for your presentation. And of course, when we go over the actual governor's bills and other bills, we will be revisiting this again. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Yeah.
Yep. And members, now while the Minnesota State Academy folks are coming up, and they can please come up right now, I just want to point out that in your packet, if you were at the hearing last night and did not bring home your notebook, your folder, our staff nicely brought it home for you and put it in your packet. And if you were not able to be there, then they gave you a packet. And so you all, unless you took it with you, should have a packet in your folder. And also, we did have comments last night from people who didn't get a chance to testify, and then they filled out a card. So in the next week or so, our staff is going to copy all those cards for all of us, and we will all get a chance to read them. So let me know when you're ready. And members, you probably know Representative Fritz represents Faribault, and so if you do you want to pull up a chair? There's one right up in the corner. Or do you want to make an introductory statement, Representative Fritz?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just want to welcome the folks from the Minnesota State Academies back up here, and also I want to welcome Linda Mitchell back from her heart transplant. I think this is true dedication, let me tell you. So with that, I'll let them proceed. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Members, the The Minnesota State Academies, of course, are in Faribault, and this committee at various times has gone to Faribault. I only had a chance to go for the first time just last year, and I would, I'm not sure when we will be going back as a committee, but if any of you are in the area, I suspect that you could call up as a legislator on this committee and get in the door, right? Superintendent Mitchell, I'm going to introduce you, and but I could I introduce the other people and see if I can pronounce Olda's last name now after my tutorial. But in the center is Roxy Mitchell, who's the Director of Education, and then Olda Bobes, right?
Bobine.
Oh, geez. I just still didn't get it right.
Bobine.
Bobine, okay. Who's the Director of Education. Welcome to the committee, Superintendent Mitchell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It is always an opportunity for us to come up here and be able to talk to legislators. And I do have to say, it's always nice if you can go first. It's hard to follow the Perpich group, but as a sister agency to them and an educational entity, we do work with Perpich with some of our programs, and it is always a pleasure for us to see them and be involved with them. Today we are here to discuss the governor's recommendations in his budget, but before we begin, we know that many of you are new to this committee, and we would like to just give you a brief snapshot of who we are and what we do. The Minnesota State Academies is one state agency made up of two schools, the Minnesota State Academy for the Blind, which Director Bobine heads up, and the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf, which Roxy Mitchell heads up. We are two schools, one state agency. We are a resource to all of the school districts in the state of Minnesota, and we provide FAPE for the state of Minnesota for children 0 to 21 who are deaf or hard of hearing or blind or visually impaired. We provide services that either are non-existent in outstate rural public schools or services which are exorbitantly expensive to provide in each district, so having them in, excuse me, in one place at the academies is a cost savings as we address some of the special needs of students who have handicapping conditions which require special assistive technology. As I say, we are special ed facilities. Our students access our schools through the IEP process in which the parents, the school district of residence, and academy staff meet through an IEP to determine the appropriate placement for the child. Now you can think of it like a three-legged school or stool, and if there is one part of that stool that is not in support of the placement, we do follow the due process of special education. We are located, as Madam Chair said, in Faribault, Minnesota. We're 50 miles south on 35W. Part of our history here, we were established in 1858 by a land grant provided by the state legislature. And this has been kind of a discussion at our schools right now because we have always said 1863. Well, we've gone back and looked at the history, and interestingly enough, because of the Civil War, the legislature did provide the establishment in 1858, but we didn't get around to opening the doors until 1863. So in 1863, the first deaf students were enrolled, and in 1866, we had the first blind students start. So we now have our history cleared up anyway. A century ago, when students would come to the academies, they might have been 9, 10, 11 years old. They stayed literally at the academies for the school year. Some, if they weren't too far away, might go home at Christmas, but otherwise they were there from the fall till the springtime. They learned a trade. We had a farm at that time, which they operated. They maybe learn to become butchers, shoemakers, barbers, carpenters, seamstresses. All of those vocational opportunities were provided, and sometimes students were there until they were 25, 26 years old. Now, in this century, I can tell you we are schools. Education is our focus. Our kids do go home every weekend. We would like to be thought of more as a prep school. Yes, we do provide residential services for our students who live too far away, obviously, to go back and forth. Right now, probably a third of our students come from the surrounding areas and are able to commute back and forth via buses or vans to their home communities and to their families at night. Our funding does come through a legislative appropriation. The basic aid revenue that follows children when they attend school in the state comes with the child to the academies, but then that money goes back to the state treasury. There is a little glitch in there, which was changed a few years ago. For the numbers of students that we have above 175, we get to keep the basic aid revenue in our budget. So other than that, the management aides, if a child should require a one-to-one management aid with them during the school day, the local school district of residence does pay for that, and transportation is provided by the school districts. Other than that, all of the funding comes from the legislature. I'm going to turn this over to Roxy and let her talk a little bit about the deaf school.
Director Mitchell.
We have two Mitchells here. Committee members, again, thank you for allowing us the opportunity to share some information about our schools. Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf is defined as a public school, and I think that's kind of important to hear because so frequently they think that we're an institution, and that's something that we are not. We service students at kindergarten through 12th grade, and again, because they're all on IEPs, they can be serviced through age 21 or when they reach and approach that 22nd birthday. We function under the same guidelines as any other public school. We follow the same graduation standards. We participate in any of the standardized testing that you use with the students in the public schools, such as your BSTs, your MCA assessments. Our teachers, because it is a special education facility, have to be highly qualified within the content areas of reading, language, social studies, and sciences. But in addition to that, our teachers also have to be certified in deaf education. And there's also a statute that requires that our teachers and educational staff meet a specific sign language proficiency level, because we are an agency that signs at all times. We do provide a free and appropriate public education as dictated by the students' IEPs. And when we have related services on the IEPs, the funding that we receive, we also provide those services as well. And that means OT, PT, speech and language services, audiological services, or anything else that might be dictated to meet the needs of the child. We are a residential program. We do provide after-school activities. Our students are also members of the Minnesota State High School League, and so they participate in specific athletic conferences. And so, again, I think the one difference between the students that are hearing in the public schools and ours is our students are deaf. They're hard of hearing or they're deaf. Our students, as far as their academic abilities, can range from someone who is near perfect on an ACT score to someone who is severely cognitively delayed. And so, again, I think we cross the gamut, even though we're a low-incidence population, we cross the gamut as to the abilities and the strengths of our students. Our admissions criteria, basically, they must meet the criterion to be deaf and hard of hearing, but they also have to be on an IEP, or an individualized education program. The current students, again, as I said, have varying academic abilities. The one thing that seems to be an obstacle for our students, and it's very common across the board, it's common for many of our students to come and not be at age grade level with their language acquisition. Much of that may be due to lack of early exposure to communication, different communication modalities, or early language acquisition opportunities. One of the statistics that I did pull from our BST test scores was our students that came to us in 2002, only 22% passed at their reading scores. In 2006, that same group, 60% did. In math, 2002, 33%. In 2006, 54%. And much of that we attribute to the ability to have the communication modes that are necessary for the students to understand the content. Although we are very appreciative of the funding base that the governor is proposing, one of the things that we have to look at futuristically is what are the changing trends for us? What have we dealt with for students in the past, and what are we looking to the future for the students that we currently have? We do have an increased number of students with additional handicapping conditions. And with that means that the increase to the related services dramatically rises. Right now, in our student population of 141 students, 46% of them have secondary handicapping conditions. And that can range from anything from attention deficit, autism, behavioral disorder, charge syndrome, physical impairments, and cognitive delays. We also are getting increased numbers of students with cochlear implants. So that means that you have to look at the length of services that they get for speech and language, audiological services, articulation services. And it's something that in order for a student that comes to you with an implant, if it happens on a daily basis, it's not significant enough. They need to have it for an extended period of time, most frequently in the beginning stages, at least for 2 years, 5 days a week, 30-minute sessions. So that increases the needs of the staffing that we would have within those areas. We also are having an increased number of students with mental health disorders, bipolar, depression within that area. Some of them are self-screened that we don't have the ability or the expertise to service them. But the difficulty lies within with home school districts knowing that they themselves can't service them and relying on us to be the experts. And so it does create a dilemma. As we recognize that we can't totally rely upon the state for all of the funding services, I think we are trying to pursue other avenues to assist in financial assistance. One of the things that we are looking at, and we have been collaborating with Volunteers of America, through their World Grant, they come to our school and provide mental health therapy and counseling services. When they initially attended our academy and started this program with us, the students are registered at MSAD, they attend our classes, they go for their therapy sessions on our campus. Volunteers of America came to us. We started with them having one therapist come. We now have two, and we have students on a waiting list. What becomes even more difficult for us is the students that reach beyond that kind of a need. We don't have placement for them in the state of Minnesota. And so we're seeking, in collaboration with Volunteers of America, Department of Health Human Services, Department of Deaf Hard of Hearing Services, and MDE, methods that we can incorporate some type of an agency or facility to be able to assist those students within the state of Minnesota and staying within the state boundaries. And at this time, I think I'll defer it back to Superintendent Mitchell.
Superintendent Mitchell.
We'll talk about this piece of this, and then I want Mr. Bovine to get a chance to talk about the blind school as well. I think Roxy has alluded to it. What we find is that deaf children are just like all of the other children in the population, so they can have all of the needs, they can have all of the skills, and they can have all of the problems and all of the issues as any other child. Their ears just don't work. So what we are seeing, and Roxy also said that, is more complicated children coming through the doors to us. I could get on a soapbox and talk about the inclusive education and how we would like the academies to be seen on that array of services that can be offered to a child. Unfortunately, it becomes kind of a top to bottom, and the kids that we get most often are children who have failed at some other level here. And when they get to us, then yes, now they're behind in school. They may be behind 1 year, they may be behind more than that.
And so then we're trying to catch them up. Obviously, that's not an easy thing to do, but I think we're making progress. With some of the mental health issues, we have kind of exhausted our resources for what is here. And yet we still see children with more severe needs. And as you know, any child with mental health issues finding services can be a challenge. Well, if you take all of those challenges and then say also they're deaf, there are no services for them. And what is happening is for our severely mentally ill students that need these services, they're having to go out of state, and there isn't even anything here in the Midwest. So they may go to Florida, they may go to Connecticut, they may go to New Mexico, but there's nothing here. For the last 4 or 5 years, we have been in conversation with the Department of Human Services, the Volunteers of America, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Division, and the Department of Ed, and talking about how can we get a collaborative together that would meet this need. We are not coming to you now with a proposal for a program, but we want you to know that we will be coming to talk to you. We have a building on our campus that we believe could be renovated and used for a program. We are not talking about expanding our mission, which we still is education. We are here to provide the K-12 services. However, with the Volunteers of America providing the treatment piece, we believe that we could provide that facility here in our state, keep our children here. Part of what also happens when they have to go to Connecticut or someplace else is that obviously family counseling becomes much more difficult or non-existent, which also then prolongs or sometimes interferes with the success of the treatment at all. So that is something that we will be talking more about in the future with you as we explore what we hope would be something we could provide right here in our state. With that aside, I'll turn it over to Mr. Bobine to talk about the blind school.
Director Bobine.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for having me speak to you today. I look forward to the opportunity to give you some insight about our school and to be able to answer any questions that you have following our presentation. Just to kind of give you an idea about our school, many of the things that my colleague Roxy Mitchell had just mentioned also are true for the Minnesota State Academy for the Blind. We are very much of a public school. We follow the same guidelines at a public school. We expect the same high expectations that do public schools of their students, and but we use different methodologies to teach our children because that's what our children need. They're blind. We need to teach them Braille. We need to teach them to use technology and independent living skills, and I'll go through some of those things as I go on. The services that you all have some packets, so I'm just going to go through that, then I'm going to go off on a little spiel about a personal life experience that I think will be somewhat eye-opening to you. The services that we offer to enroll students is again, the core curriculum, coursework designed to meet graduating standards, including preparation for state's mandated basic skill tests. So we hold our kids to high expectations. We expect our children to be able to graduate and to be able to become productive citizens and be able to live up to their full potential and be active partners in the economy that we live in. That's our expectation for each child. Whatever their potential is, we expect them to reach the highest potential. We also use expanded core curriculum, which I will touch on in just a second here, and that is unique for children that are blind and visually impaired. A critical component to our school that is just cannot be underestimated is the importance of having staff that are specifically trained to deal with children that have visual impairments. It's having a sensory impairment is like no other disability. The way you educate children, whether they're deaf or whether they're blind, is very different from children that are sighted or children that are hearing. you know, we're also a 24-hour we offer 24-hour educational programming. Oftentimes, we stay amongst each other when we speak. It's one thing that we offer classes to our students from 8 in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But part of the education actually starts at the end of the day when they go into the dorms and they start working on the compensatory skills that they need, such as a social interaction, to learn that. You know, 93% of everything we learn comes through our eyes. That doesn't happen for children that are blind. We have to teach them and explain to them about how to act appropriately socially and all those type of things. So that part of our school is so critical to the development of our children. And the other added bonus is that those children that are in our residential facility or in the residential halls is that they have the ability to communicate and interact with other children that are blind. They don't feel like they're the only one, and I have no one to talk to. And I can tell you as a former vision teacher that used to work in the Omaha area, and I was an itinerant, I would oftentimes hear from children that were the only blind child in the school. You know, I have no friends. Well, one of the reasons that they never had any friends is because there was an adult sitting next to this child from the time that they lost their sight, whether it be in a kindergarten or later. And I don't know how many of you can remember back to the days when you were in elementary school, if you'd walk up to one of your friends that happened to be blind, but also there was Roxy Mitchell sitting next to them and want to carry on the conversation. And my blind children face that in their home districts all the time. And so when they come into this dorm, and they have other friends that have similar disabilities, they can share their feelings, their frustrations, and talk about those. And that is another critical aspect of their emotional development. We have a low teacher-pupil ratio. That is absolutely critical for the development of skills for a child that is blind, because it is such intense instruction. Last year, we began a new autism program. We started looking around at our visually impaired students, and as you probably all know, that the autism spectrum disorder, children being identified into that, is increasing rapidly. They expect in the next few years, 3 of 10 of children, 30% of children, are going to have autism spectrum disorder. That's huge numbers. Those children, again, need specialized training. We've developed a program where we started last year with one child. This year we have 7 children in there already. And it's fantastic. Parents are coming to us and saying, my gosh, I never thought my child would be able to do these things. It's the specialized instructions, the devoted of incredibly gifted staff, that allows children to make progress. Now, I'd like to just kind of go into an outreach mode here and a little bit about my life experience. I had a student when I worked in the Omaha area who was a fourth grader and lost his vision due to a brain tumor. And it was close to his optic nerve, and when they had to go in and radiate him, there was a chance that this young man was going to go blind. And in fact, that is what happened. And when I'm talking about this, I certainly don't want to portray myself as some kind of a person that has all the answers to everything, because I don't. I only have my life experiences. But I can tell you what happened to this child. This child lost his sight, like I said, as a fourth grader. And I started working with him when he was in the seventh grade. This child was unable to read, had no braille skills, had no math skills, had been labeled mildly mentally handicapped. The district had sent him away for an evaluation that said that he would never be able to live independently, that he would always need to, he could never do anything but basic mathematics. A pretty grim picture. That caught mother and father causing tremendous turmoil within the family, guilt that comes along with that for parents. I started working with Adam, and I had an incredible director of special education that I worked for that really believed in Adam. And he said, you know, Olda, he said, I want you to do whatever you can to let this child live as a normal life as possible. And I said, fine, Dr. Dennis, I will do that. And so I walked into his office about 2 weeks after and I started, and I said, the paraprofessional that works with this child has got to go. Because Adam was not doing any of the work, the paraprofessional was doing it. She was being re-educated how to add and subtract and multiply, and Adam was getting straight A's on everything, but Adam could not do one problem. He could not read one word of Braille. He did not know one contraction. He did not know his Nemeth code, any of those things. I started working with Adam, called his mom, and I said, I would like to teach Adam how to read. And she said, well, we've done all this testing. We don't think he's going to be able to read. I said, I'd just like to try. So we did. I'll try to end the story quickly because there's so much to it, and it points to every student that is blind throughout the state of Minnesota of what is happening, what I truly believe is happening, not in the state of Minnesota, but I worked in Iowa, I worked in Nebraska, it's happening all over the place, and that you can't include children in an inclusionary setting that have a disability such as blindness or deafness until they learn the basic skills, and then inclusion will work. Here's the ending of Adam. Adam now is in law school in Nebraska. He learned how to read. Within 3 years, he was reading 142 minutes, 132 words a minute in Braille, when everybody said that he could not do it. He was taking advanced courses in physics. He was taking biology, feeling with his hand where the organs of the cat were. He learned he had technology that if a teacher gave him a piece of paper so that he could get the things at the same exact time as his sighted peers, he could bring it into his room, scan it, bring it out in Braille, go back up to his classroom, and be an active participant in the classroom. He did it. And many children can do that. The key is that children have to be able to read. Blind children have to be able to read. And every attempt has got to be made to give them plenty of opportunity to learn to read. It's not a 15, 20 minute thing. Like, I have 7 children. I practice reading with them 15, 20 minutes a day every day. A blind student, it's an all day thing. If they don't have the Braille, they don't have what their sighted peers have in front of them. It's going to take them much longer to do that. But once they learn, they can be as competitive as their sighted peers. Adam now is in law school. I think it's a dramatic testimony to what I call a lack of opportunity to learn. When we go and we identify a child as blind, and if somehow they're not making progress, we soon add another tag onto them and say that they're mildly mentally handicapped or they have a learning disability or some other thing because they're not learning at the pace they need. The sensory impairment is very different, and they have to be educated in a very different way. And if we do that, we can be successful with a vast majority of blind children that someday could sit in the chairs that all of us occupy today. Thank you.
Thank you. We all love a story, especially a good ending and a good use of tax dollars to boot. So thank you very much. Is this the end of your presentation, Superintendent Mitchell?
If I could, I would like to comment on the governor's budget recommendations.
Please,
here.
That would be great.
Just to go through those briefly. And this first item is funding for our campus security system. I have informally said, you know, we are in Faribault and have not had the need to have fences around our campuses or a great deal of security. Not that we do not, and I will say this, we do practice lockdowns and all of the other kinds of kind of preventative, proactive procedures necessary should we have a crisis on our campus. So I know for both of the schools, we do go through practice lockdowns to make sure that we've ironed out all the bugs, which can be a challenge. We have two campuses. We are about a half mile apart between the two. We have 16 buildings, and while we have
locked the outside doors around the perimeters and made things safer, we feel, inside. We do not have the kinds of security that we now feel is necessary as we watch the world change and things become more violent. We are requesting funding. This will allow us to put cameras to monitor the entrances into our buildings. It will provide us with a key card system for our staff so that we will be able to make things more secure and more safe for our students. The next piece, and I wrote this down because for both of these disability groups, access to information, communication access is really the most important thing. It's not what we do for these two schools that is different, because what we do is education. It's how it's done, obviously done very differently for a blind child than it is for a deaf child. But technology has become the kind of, let's make the playing field even for everybody, because now with the sidekicks for our deaf students and the computers with the voice access for the blind students, they can do everything everybody else can do, and probably a lot faster than those of us who are a little older. So computer technology is huge, and we have one of our technologists with us today, but I can tell you we have two on staff for our agency, which is 200-plus employees plus another 100 and, well, almost 200 students. So these two folks have been run ragged, and I can't say enough good about what they do. But there is funding in our budget now to add more technology staff, which we would certainly put to good use. There is also funding in the Enterprise Technology Office set aside for the academies, which we will be writing our plans appropriately to access those funds for the things that we need. Because, admittedly, the assistive technology is expensive. It's not cheap. And I know if I turn this over to Olda to talk about a Braille note or a PacMate, some of the things that then allow a blind child to be able to take notes in class and keep up with what's going on. And I think one of those is like $5,000. So we're not talking anything that is cheap, but again, it provides them with the necessary equipment so that they can function as an equal in a regular classroom. So the mainstreaming contract funding is a piece a couple of years ago with some of the changes that were made. We both of the schools, mainstream students into the Faribault Public Schools, so that these kids are able to have a mainstream experience in a regular classroom with non-handicapped peers. It's a wonderful experience for all of the kids. Some of them spend more time at the public school than others, but it's good exposure for all of them. In some changing in funding, we are now, and it wasn't an increase to our budget, but it was money that Faribault was paying before and has now been shifted to our budget. So this $50,000 that is in there is kind of helping correct that shift. And the last piece, which I, the compensation adjustment, I will say that over the last 4 or 5 years, as I look out at other state agencies, we have not been cut as severely as some of the other agencies have been. So we are thankful for that. But I can also tell you that we are down to, we have teachers, we have the administrators, we have the dorm staff. We really don't have anything extra. And we have also absorbed as the cost of living, contracts, et cetera, insurance has gone up. We've continued to absorb that. We appreciate the 2% that's been added to our budget for that this year. My fear is that I don't think it's going to be enough. So without saying then here's all these other things that we need, there are other things that we would like to see included, one of which is outreach for the blind school. We talk about our enrolled students, but we also serve students who are out in their resident school districts. And for the blind children, some of that is short-term services,
they may only need some help with learning O&M, which is orientation and mobility, so that they can learn their way around. It may be that they need to learn Braille, and once they've got Braille, they can stay in their own classrooms. But providing those short-term services has become a larger and larger piece of what MSAB as in boy is doing. We can see that expanding. I think Aldous says now we have 3 staff members who do that. I can tell you that even for southern Minnesota, that could probably be 5.
We could do 5 easily.
So those are the kinds of challenges that we are facing.
All right. Thank you very much. We have a question from Representative Van Zels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I struggle a bit with the reluctance of state agencies to function collaboratively, to partner, and to jointly target resources to target populations, not a very good word, to people. Who are slices of the community. Mm-hmm. State services for the blind and state services for the deaf are located within the State Department of Human Services. Could you talk a little bit about whatever level of collaboration and partnering and services that are shared? And of course, why I'm asking is, of course, all of us are struggling with maximizing resources, mm-hmm. and we certainly want to do the best we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could start now.
Director Bolton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have been working on creating a collaborative relationship with Adult Services for the Blind. I believe, as you so eloquently said, that there is many opportunities for us to collaborate. For example, where I did my training at the University of North Dakota, there's a blind school there as well. It serves adult people that resulting from car accidents, brain tumors, other health-related issues that they may have had, that go to the academy for short-term programming to address Braille, for example, or retraining for other work type of opportunities. The example that I vividly sticks out to me is we had a gentleman that was involved in a car accident and lost both of his eyes, and he was an accountant. So we were teaching him Braille and the Nemeth code so he could continue in that field. He loved to do that work. But there was a whole thing, as my colleague Mitchell had said, Roxy, that you know, we had to work through many things too. It wasn't just a matter of that part of the collaboration. There was also the mental health aspect that, you know, that this man was going through, his family. I mean, sudden vision loss, just like that. But there are certainly, and there should be certainly, opportunities, and we're working on those. I'm working on those, but it's at the beginning stages, and I agree with you.
In your opinion, where should the direction for that kind of collaboration come from? Should it come from the legislature prescribing functions that require collaboration, or should it be left to simply the executive branch that manages those agencies?
That to me is a very complex question, and that would deserve a lot of discussion between the entities involved on how best to put that together. I think that my opinion would probably scratch the surface, and people from other organizations would have other opinions, but I certainly agree with you that there could be collaboration.
Superintendent Mitchell?
My only comment would be, Madam Chair and committee members, that as you talk about how things are sliced, our focus for us has been the children. We can serve from 0 to 21. And I guess I would say that I'm not even sure that there's resistance in that we would love to be able to provide things to folks who were older than 21, but at some point then wait a minute, the money was given to us for this, how would we expand it? I think it is very challenging, and I wouldn't disagree at all that none of us, especially for this low incidence population, we don't want to duplicate services. It's hard enough to provide the services. We would prefer to fill the gaps, however that would work. I think it's a longer discussion about how we would do that.
Representative Van Zels.
Thank you. Thank you for using low incidence population. That's what I was reaching for when I used the hard word. I apologize.
Any other questions for members? Representative Rodriguez. Or Rodriguez, Dominguez.
Oops. Strange name. It happens. A couple things. One thing is that I have a close friend that works for the Vision Law Center in Minneapolis, and I've had a lot of good conversation. He became blind in his mid-30s, and now he carries a box, and he's working for them now. He learned to deal with his blindness. And I commend you for your work you're doing with the children, but we kind of overlook the adults also. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that with diabetes so strong within our communities, they go blind. And it's known in our community, minority community especially, because of the diets and so on and so forth. Have you worked with that community? And another question, as far as the death children that you're working with, are you working or have you worked with different cultural languages, and how do you work with that?
Deputy Mitchell,
I will respond to the cultural thing. Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, it is not uncommon when we have a student that comes in. You have to understand that they think that ASL is a universal language. It is not. It is not. Every country has their own format of what ASL is. Now, there may be similarities and overlapping similarities between them, but they never will be identical. They may have a different form of grammar. They may have a different form of syntax or whatever. But with that said, for the students that come to our agency, and I'll use, for example, a student that may come in and the parents have come from Cambodia. And they have a language of Khmer. We will send out to them any records that are necessary in the language of Khmer. When the parents come to an IEP meeting or any other meeting that they are involved in, we will have a ASL interpreter, we will have a Khmer interpreter, and we may have English language being spoken at the same time, and in the order of the communication that is necessary. So we do look at it from that standpoint. We also work with cultural liaisons to be sure that we are meeting the needs of the students that are coming into our school. I mean, so because it can vary, and they do have different needs.
I just to address the vision
Mr.
portion of it.
Mr. Obin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I came from Lexington, Nebraska, coming back to Minnesota. Lexington, Nebraska was a meatpacking community where we had 84% minority children. Some of them had visual impairments. I was a director of special education there. So the cultural factor, I think I understand that very well. I also, I wasn't born in the United States. I was born in Czechoslovakia, came here as a 7-year-old. So I understand the language problems that occur. I also understand that in translation, when you're speaking with parents or when you're educating children, I found that out more so in Lexington than anywhere else that I've been employed or have lived. That you need to assure that the child has the basic knowledge of their own formal, their initial language first, before you start educating them in anything else. So, for example, in the Braille, I would assure that the child is reading, if it is a Spanish-speaking student, that we would teach them to learn Spanish, Braille in Spanish first, so that the parents could support that, and then go into the English and do them simultaneously. That's critical to the development of kids and the maintaining and the maintenance of the culture.
Thank you very much, members. Our time is up, but I'm going to let one more. We have more members on the list, so I'll take one more question. And thank you very much. And if anybody has to go, feel free to go. But otherwise, those who can stay, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm a product of the Federal Public Schools. And I remember back in, I graduated in 69, and my experiences with the extracurricular activities, the sports, and those types of activities, I can remember playing football against the school, the deaf, and also wrestling with the blind. Very impressed, and as a young student myself, it made a big impression on me and the effort that those students put forward. And then being able to coach some athletes myself with that were blind really gave me a really respect for that. So just thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you. Superintendent Mitchell.
Thank you. If I may, just in closing, there's two things. First of all, we are only 50 miles down the road, so if you're traveling down 35W, please stop and see us. It's very hard to really put into words the essence of what these people do, but if you come and see it in action, that's really the best thing. So we certainly invite you anytime. We're there in the summer. We have summer school programs that go on, so please stop in anytime. If you have questions, we have our cards in there. You can certainly contact us. If you have free time, and I know this is not the time of year that you usually do, but our websites are there. Also would like to add that you should have a DVD in your packet. Just want to let you know that was created by our high school students at the deaf school. We, in talking about technology, used some funding a couple of years ago to create a TV studio, and they are now creating all kinds of things, and this is one of their products. So, yeah, enjoy that.
Thank you very much. And the meeting's adjourned.